From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he's ready to resume rallies this weekend, but he's still not willing to do a virtual debate with Joe Biden next week. On Fox News last night, Trump also declined to say whether he's tested negative for the coronavirus since his diagnosis last week. And he struggled to speak when talking about the only kind of mail-in voting he supports.
Absentee is okay, because absentee ballots, excuse me, absentee ballots are fine.
Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC News and joins us now. Beth, some people are going to listen to that clip and say, well, Trump could be very sick. Why would he be holding a rally?
Well, we know that he loves holding rallies and that he was doing that even in defiance of health guidelines in many of the states that he was visiting. We also know that being sick is just sort of against his brand. He projects strength, or his of course, effort is to project strength and solidity and being defiant, and being ill and being sidetracked and sidelined contradicts that completely. So he's very eager to get out there to resume what he considers to be his normal way of communicating with voters, which is in person, those rallies with lots of red hats, people who love him, people who adore him. And that to him is how he won in 2016 and why he wants to get back out there.
Beth, we're 25 days out from the election now, and many people are already voting. Biden is leading in almost every poll. Can the president turn this around?
Well, of course he can, and there's many different pathways to do that, because as you know, the whole race is decided in the Electoral College, and there are Electoral College paths for the president that continue to exist. Those three Midwestern states that he won and surprised everybody by doing so, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, many polls there show a very tight race. He still has the backing of many, many Republicans in some of the bigger swing states, including Florida. So he certainly can pull this out. But there is no question, as you say, that polling right now looks very much to be in the former vice president's favor.
The president's behavior this week has been under scrutiny, in part because he's been on a steroid to treat the virus, which can alter moods. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling for the creation of a commission that, when needed, would determine if a president is unfit and should be removed.
This is not about President Trump. He will face the judgment of the voters. But he shows the need for us to create a process for future presidents.
What is she talking about here? Was that just a stunt on her part?
Well, it's funny that she's saying it's not about President Trump, because it clearly is about President Trump. She's raised questions about whether he has sort of the mental fitness at this moment because of his illness and because of his treatment to conduct business as president. So it's a pretty bold move by Nancy Pelosi. I mean, obviously, this isn't really going to go anywhere, but she's taking a stand publicly saying that President Trump is behaving in ways that are alarming and that potentially could need to be curtailed by Congress.
The president now says he's ready to make a big COVID relief bill with Pelosi. And on CNBC this morning, Republican Senator Ted Cruz accused Pelosi of holding up a deal to hurt the president. But Cruz also said he thinks Trump would win big if people are going back to work, or lose in a landslide, quote, of Watergate proportions if people are angry and broke. Do you think a relief bill is still possible, and would it play a role in this election?
Well, the president's really been all over the map on this. I mean, just this week, on Tuesday, he announced that he wanted his negotiators to walk away from any sort of large deal and instead focus on the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett as his new Supreme Court justice. But then just in the last couple of days, the White House team and President Trump have indicated they might be open to a bigger deal, realizing probably smartly that voters would be very happy to get some additional relief before the election. But, you know, it may not be possible at this point. Nancy Pelosi is going to have her own reasons for doing things as well. And because the president has sent so many conflicting messages, it's very hard for her and for other Democrats to sort of climb on board with a plan that still would have to go through the Republican controlled Senate when President Trump is being so all over the map about this.
What about Amy Coney Barrett? What are you expecting next week when the confirmation hearings start for her?
Well, the Democrats have been pretty disciplined up to this point about talking about Amy Coney Barrett, that they've really been sort of uniting around a message that her ascending to the court would threaten the Affordable Care Act, because she has written some critical things about that in the past, and because the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is coming before the Supreme Court in November. It seems to be a strategy that the Democrats have decided to adopt, is rather than be sort of all over the map on criticizing her and her conservative positions on number of issues, that they will go straight to the heart of something that matters to a lot of people, and that is health insurance.
That is Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Michigan now, where Governor Gretchen Whitmer today called out President Trump's rhetoric as one of the reasons an extremist group hatched a now foiled plot to kidnap her. 13 men who were part of the group, the Wolverine Watchmen, faced several charges, including terrorism and conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Authorities say the group also wanted to bomb the state capitol and incite a civil war before the election. For more on the latest, let's go to Rick Pluta, who covers state politics for Michigan Public Radio Network. And Rick, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
Rick, for people just tuning into this shocking story, remind us who these men are and how this plot got exposed by the FBI.
They are members of basically two small cells that self-identify as part of the militia movement. They're vigilantes, basically. And they found each other and they started plotting different ways that they could basically get back at the government, in part because of COVID-19 restrictions, but they're basically anti-government. And then as the plot got further and further along and it turned to kidnapping Governor Whitmer and putting her on quote-unquote trial for treason, which we don't know what they were planning, but traditionally is a death penalty offense, one of the conspirators got cold feet and got in touch with the authorities. That's the story, according to the FBI and the Michigan State Police.
You mentioned this. There's been a lot of vitriol in the state against Governor Whitmer for placing Michigan under some of the strictest lockdown orders in the country when the pandemic was just cresting in the spring. We recall that many armed rallies actually took place in response to the state capitol in Lansing. Is this what authorities suspect motivated these Wolverine Watchmen?
Well, what they say is that one of these gun rights rallies, one of these armed rallies where some of the protesters brought firearms into the state Senate gallery is where the initial group of conspirators actually met up and decided that they wanted to do something more. And so, yeah, I mean, this was absolutely about a whole bunch of things, a strong anti-government sentiment, gun rights, and this feeling that the governor was just imposing too many public health restrictions on people.
Well, Governor Whitmer has been very clear that she believes President Trump is complicit in this domestic terrorism plot against her and the people of Michigan. Here she is on Good Morning America. Let's listen.
Each time that he has said, liberate Michigan, and said, I should negotiate with the very people who were arrested because they're good people, that incites more domestic terror.
Rick, we recall Michigan is the state that President Trump won by just 11,000 votes in 2016. How are people there reacting to this?
Well, I think that people are shocked regardless. As a matter of fact, it took a while for a lot of people to just react because the situation is so bizarre. When you look at the election, that Michigan remains sort of firmly locked in the leans Biden camp. And so I think the question is, in terms of reaction and acting on that reaction, is how does this motivate people? Does it motivate more people to want to get out and vote, especially during these times when voting itself is very unusual? And there are questions about, how ballots are going to be counted. What's the situation going to be like at polls for people who choose to vote in person, which I guess is just a long way of saying that there's just a whole lot of I don't know out there.
Yeah. You know, we know a lot of people, though, took issue with Whitmer's lockdown orders, mm-hmm. not just these extremist groups. The state Supreme Court just last week ruled that she did not have the authority to unilaterally extend the state's lockdown order past April 30th. So with the 30 seconds I have with you, where does this put Michigan now?
Okay, so very quickly, the state Supreme Court's ruling was an advisory ruling to a federal court, although that seems pretty clear the direction that it's taking. And so what the administration's response was to issue, instead of executive orders, public health orders that largely do the same thing. And we may see more legal challenges to those as well.
That's Rick Pluta, who covers state politics for Michigan Public Radio. Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lenny Kravitz is a four-time Grammy Award winner who sold millions of albums. Here's just a few of his hits. I want to get away. I want to fly. I belong to you. And you, you, you belong to me. American woman. Stay away from me. Some other fun facts. Kravitz also has his own design firm and appeared in two Hunger Games movies. So when I heard he wrote a memoir with David Ritz, I thought it would contain all the juicy parts of being a rock star. But no.
I didn't want it to be about fame or rock stardom or anything like that. I wanted it to be about the journey.
Lenny Kravitz's book, Let Love Rule, focuses on the foundation, the first 25 years of his life that led to the man we know today. It's out this week, and Lenny Kravitz joined us to talk about it. You dedicate this book to your mother, Roxy Roker. She was well known, best known for playing Helen Willis, one half of one of TV's first interracial couples in The Jeffersons. And you write in the book that Gladys Knight's voice gave sound to your mother's soul. And man, I felt that description in my soul. But can you say more about that?
Well, Gladys Knight was one of the first voices that I fell in love with. My mother and I used to listen to records at night, and I would sing for her, stand in front of her and sing the songs that were coming off of the turntable. And one of my favorite albums was Gladys Knight and the Pips, Imagination. There was just something about Gladys and her voice that gave voice to my mother's soul.
I guess you could say that I've been lucky. Oh, I guess you could say that it's all because of you.
And if we could describe Gladys Knight's voice, it is warm, it is like comfort, it is like a cradle in many ways. And you tell these beautiful stories about your mother, how when you were a child and something would upset you, she'd bring out this magical character, Ruff Ruff. Can you tell us more about that?
She wanted me to have a way to express myself, and she knew that I wouldn't necessarily always want to talk to my quote-unquote mother, you know? So she created a character, and the character was this sort of magical dog. And what I would have to do is I would have to say abracadabra, and then she would say Ruff Ruff. From that moment on, she was Ruff Ruff, and she had a completely different voice, different body language. And I would spill my feelings, you know, my fears, my insecurities, my happinesses, whatever it was. And when we were finished, I would have to say abracadabra again, and then she would turn back to my mother. In retrospect, it was a brilliant way for us to communicate, and she was smart enough to come up with that method.
Yeah. Your father, Cy Kravitz, was a former military man, and he was really strict and hard on you. This book, you really illustrate how you felt he didn't understand you, but he did understand your love of music. He was the one who took you to your first Jackson 5 concert, and it was in that moment that you felt like you were actually seen by your father.
Yes.
Was it cathartic to write about your relationship?
It was. You know, we had a very challenging relationship, but that doesn't mean we didn't love each other and that we didn't respect each other. we just had a hard time connecting. And the beautiful thing about writing this book was that I was able to see my father as a character. Because when you're writing the book, everyone's a character. I'm a character. You get to back off of yourself and other people. And through seeing him as a character, I got to really understand that he was just a man trying to get through this life experience with the best that he had. And through seeing him with those eyes, any judgment that I had just began to evaporate. And it was really healing. And my love for him grew in writing this book.
You know, it was such a treat to read about all of the legendary artists you were surrounded by during your childhood. I mean, what a charmed life to have five play aunties that included Diane Carroll and Cicely Tyson. I mean, that's like the high bar for play aunties. And you say Black feminine energy is one of the reasons you've held your sanity for so long. Can you say more?
Yes, I was so blessed. My mother, my grandmother, my aunts. I felt comfortable around these women. I felt seen. I felt loved. I felt nurtured. And I felt their strength. And that fed me throughout my life. I would not be who I am or where I am in this life without that feminine Black energy.
Yeah. Another fun fact, you auditioned and were accepted into the California Boys Choir, singing classical music. What did that experience teach you?
Well, it taught me so much about music and music that I wasn't as familiar with, classical music. It taught me so much about harmony. It opened up my ear. Being around all of these orchestras, I got to sing in the Metropolitan Opera. I did about 15 different operas. And I got to record with amazing maestros, Zubin Mehta. So being around all of that music really opened my ear and gave me an education that I use to this day. And it was heavy discipline. This was serious business.
You know, it was so fun to read about the backstories of some of the iconic moments or songs, like How Somebody's Watching Me was originally presented to you. It later became a hit for your friend, Kennedy Gordy. The chance to be a part of a group, which was going to be the Black Duran Duran Man. I mean, if that had happened. In the book, it seemed like you were even surprised at your own resolve at such a young age to turn down opportunities that could have actually made you a lot of money. What do you think it was within you that made you so clear-headed about who you were and who you are?
Well, first of all, it was never about the money. For me, it was about expressing myself in a very natural way, in a true way. Now, mind you, I hadn't found my sound yet, right? So why didn't I take the deal and say, okay, I'll do this for now. And if I have success in this situation, I will develop and I'll change and I'll become who I would become. But even though I hadn't found my sound yet, I knew that what they were presenting me with was not my sound. So why even go down that avenue? I still can't explain how I had the power to do that when I was living in a car or living on people's floor or on a couch or sleeping in recording studio lounges at night. I don't know how I had the strength to do that. But every time I got close to that contract and they wanted me to sign, I felt physically ill. I couldn't do it. And I looked ridiculous to everybody. Everyone told me I was stupid and I was crazy and what's your problem? But as I learned in life, we can be presented with many open doors in our life, but it doesn't mean that you have to walk through them. And I was waiting for my door, and I'm so thankful that I did.
One of the people who helped you actually find your sound and help you find that door is Lisa Bonet. Your relationship and continued friendship is just legendary. You know, y'all need to write a book on blended families, you know, that, how to have wonderful relationships with ex-spouses. How did she help you find your sound?
You know, she was and is such a powerful person, a natural person, an enlightened person. And so when we met, I saw myself in her. I really feel that we were mirror images of each other. And through our friendship, because it began as a friendship, through our love, through our life, our circle of friends, the magic that was around all of us, it just enabled me to come to a place where I was finally comfortable with myself. Because remember, I'm coming out of that whole Romeo Blue phase.
Yeah, your name was Romeo Blue for a moment.
Yeah, it was an alter ego, you know, whatever you want to call it. It was a character for my music because I didn't think Lenny Kravitz was enough. So I was coming off of that phase when we met and then went back to my name after we'd met. And all of that that was going on around us in our world somehow opened a portal. All of a sudden, the sound that I was looking for was there, and I heard it, and I followed it, and that became my sound.
Well, the title of this memoir is Let Love Rule, and of course, it's also the title of your first album and one of your biggest mm-hmm. songs. Sounds like this is also how you see your life.
Yes. I mean, Let Love Rule is it. That's the statement, and it has been for 30 years, and that is the way I try to live my life every day. Yeah.
Lenny Kravitz, his new memoir is Let Love Rule. Lenny, thank you so much for this conversation and thank you for your book.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your time and having this discussion with you.
Demand is dropping for programs that help struggling homeowners avoid foreclosures during the pandemic. Last week, the number of homeowners who took advantage of pandemic-related mortgage bailout plans fell below 3 million for the first time since April. And active forbearances dropped by 18% as the six-month expiration date on those plans approaches. Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Tanya.
So last week's decline in forbearances, which lets people put off paying their mortgages if they've been affected by the pandemic, was more significant than in July when the first round of forbearances were 3 months along. What's behind this sharp drop? Are people suddenly doing better?
So forbearance really means patience, right? The idea that there's some short-term reason you can't pay your mortgage. Now think about that. For most people who own a home or have a mortgage, the mortgage is probably their single biggest expense. And so as people got laid off and shutdown started rolling in March, the first thing people did was call their banks and say, hey, can we put this off? Now, Black Knight, which is the company behind all this data, says there's clearly a sign of long-term improvement. Some people are back at work. As a result, they're now back to paying their loans. There are still a lot of Americans who are in trouble. Probably a third of all American households are saying that they're facing either eviction or foreclosure. In five states, Nebraska, Wyoming, North Carolina, Louisiana, Nevada, that number is more than 50%. So we're not out of the woods, but yes, it does look like there is some improvement on the horizon.
Well, what options are available to homeowners who need help with their mortgage payments right now still?
Well, it depends on what sort of mortgage you have. If it's a government-backed mortgage, meaning backed by Fannie and Freddie, the Federal Housing Authority, the VA, or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that's about two-thirds of all loans. You can get a forbearance for 360 days. You get it for 180 days, and then you can apply for an extension for another 180 days. But about 400,000 people who have federally backed mortgages are described as being needlessly delinquent. For some reason, they didn't apply for this. So it seems like the message didn't get out there. About a third of all mortgages, about 14 and a half or 15 million, are privately owned, meaning they're through a bank and they're not backed by a federal insurance program. Most of the banks I've studied are offering some sort of version of forbearance, not forgiveness. You do owe all the money in the end, but an ability to put off payments. It's a matter of talking to either your bank or the federal program that insures your mortgage.
Yeah. You know, economists are saying this huge drop in mortgage assistance plans is a sign that the market is actually improving. But could the absence of another coronavirus relief package throw that progress down the drain?
Yeah, look, a lot of things are happening. First of all, interest rates are very low, and that's spurring home buying, and prices are up. So if you have a mortgage, at least you don't have, it's not like 2008 or 2009 where your house value had come down. But of course, if you're without a job, you can't get a new mortgage or you can't refinance it. There is a real worry. You know, every 2 hours we get new news on whether or not there's going to be another program. If there isn't one, there are a lot of warnings, including one from the chair of the Federal Reserve, that if we do too little, we'll end up with a weak recovery and a whole bunch of people will continue to suffer.
That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. As always, thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Even if you put aside the global pandemic, the fight over a rescue bill for the U.S. economy, and everything else, it's still a pretty astonishing story that President Trump has coronavirus, and so do so many people in his inner circle, including his campaign manager, his press secretary, and his wife, the First Lady. It's something that's never happened before in any White House. Former White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta joins us now. He served in that role for President Clinton. He was also director of the CIA and later Secretary of Defense under former President Obama. Secretary Panetta, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, and the president says he wants to hold rallies as soon as this weekend. He won't say whether he has yet tested negative for the coronavirus. What do you make of all of this?
Well, it's cause for concern because when the president of the United States gets ill and is incapacitated by something as serious as COVID-19. It raises national security issues, and it also raises concern about the confidence of the American people in whether or not the duties and responsibilities of the presidency are being carried out. And right now, the danger is that because of the lack of credible information about the status of the president as to whether or not he is negative or he still remains positive with COVID-19, the failure to kind of provide full information about just exactly how serious this illness is, and then to have him decide he's going to jump back into the campaign trail without providing any of that information, I think that's just going to further harm confidence in the ability of this president to do the job.
Well, what would you be doing if you were chief of staff right now? Because obviously the White House is concerned about getting information out there that may make the president look weak. The doctors wouldn't tell anyone what his chest x-rays said, for example. They wouldn't say exactly what his fever was.
Well, you know, we've been through this, you know, certainly with Ronald Reagan, who was shot and but was willing to be cared for, and they provided full information about his status at the time. And he was willing to remain cared for until he was well enough to be able to assume the responsibilities of the presidency. Look, what should happen here? First and foremost, the president should be cared for and get well. And, you know, the attitude has been they rushed him to Walter Reed instead of staying there and getting well and, you know, losing his contagiousness. He jumped right back in the White House and said everything's fine and he's been cured. He ought to be cared for. He ought to get well so that he can resume his duties. Secondly, there ought to be a command structure that is established around the president to implement the duties and responsibilities of the president. This has been pretty hit and miss, and what they should do, the chief of staff, key members of the cabinet, national security advisor, is provide a command structure that makes clear to the American people the duties of the presidency are being fulfilled. And lastly, there ought to be briefings to the public. When a president gets ill, that is not a private matter. It's a public matter. And it's important to provide briefings on the status of the president. And instead of doing that, you know, they're kind of doing hit and miss, sending letters out, not providing a full range of information as to the status of the presidency. And that creates a lot of distrust about just exactly what's happening with this president. So there's a way to do this, and the way is to try to restore confidence, public confidence in the president and in the White House and their ability to carry out the duties and responsibilities that they're assigned.
Well, speaking of the command structure, all of the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have had to quarantine at home after contact last week with an admiral who later tested positive. A Pentagon spokesman said this has not affected the operational readiness of the armed forces. But was it too risky for all of these members of the Joint Chiefs to be in one meeting together during a pandemic?
Well, again, when you have the president ill, when you have some 27 members of the White House staff ill, when you have his campaign people ill, when you suddenly have members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff falling ill as well, that creates a kind of scary moment for whether or not the United States of America has the leadership in place that is necessary in order to protect our security. I'm sure that they are communicating with one another. I'm sure that they're continuing to do their responsibilities. But it's a moment, frankly, where the chief of staff has to show that there is a structure in place to be able to deal with the issues and concerns facing this country, and that the business of the nation is being done, despite the fact that there are these people that are impacted, that there's a communication system, that there's a staff system that's been set up in order to deal with the problems facing the country. None of that has been provided to the public. So here we are, listening to members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff falling ill, members of the White House staff falling ill. There's no pattern for tracing just exactly what happened here and how they're being cared for. The White House is half empty as a result of that. Who's on the job of doing the nation's business? That's the fundamental question.
The president has tweeted a lot in the last week, and one of his tweets may have gotten lost, but it's quite important. He said that all U.S. troops should be home from Afghanistan by Christmas, which is a faster timeline than earlier plans. There are more than 8,000 troops there now. Is that feasible, do you think, and is it a good idea?
Well, again, it's obviously the way this president does business, which is to do hundreds of tweets about different things, kind of reflecting his own judgment and not, frankly, the best judgment of his staff, of his military advisors, of his State Department advisors, all of whom have made clear that the United States ought to not remove our troops from Afghanistan unless there are firm conditions in place that the Taliban is going to abide by. That's what they said. It was the right thing to say. And here's the president saying, no, to hell with it. We're going to bring the troops home by Christmas no matter what. It's a terrible signal that was sent to the Taliban. And they were very happy to hear the president say that because it basically meant they don't have to negotiate a damn thing. That's not the way business should be done, particularly with regards to national security issues.
Secretary Panetta, I want to ask you one more thing, and it's kind of a big question, which is that a lot of Democrats are looking to this election like it's going to change everything if President Trump loses. Do you think that that is the case, or do you think that this country is going to remain just as divided the day after, no matter what happens?
We're facing a lot of problems in this country, a lot of crises. Obviously, the pandemic, a recession, concerns about racial equality, the whole issue of the integrity of the election, and concerns about whether our democracy can function. I mean, we've had a largely dysfunctional Washington between the president and the Congress, both parties, the inability to develop the aid that's necessary to deal with COVID-19, the inability to deal with a number of important issues facing the country. And so there's a lot of distrust. There's a lot of polarization in the country. None of that is going away the day after the election. None of that. And a new president, should there be a new president, will have to confront that, and so will the political leadership of this country have to confront that. Is this going to be a time of suddenly dramatic change? No. It's going to be a time when people are really going to have to roll up their sleeves and try to make sure that our democracy can function.
That is Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense, former CIA Director, former White House Chief of Staff. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
By the way, big picture on the coronavirus, more than 56,000 new cases in the U.S. yesterday, more than 900 new deaths. The worst hotspots for new cases, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin.
Colorado was once considered a Republican state, but over the last few years, it's become increasingly Democrat. For instance, the last three presidential elections have been in favor of Democratic candidates. And again this year, pollsters see Colorado leaning Democrat, but the state itself is still divided, especially in smaller, more rural communities. For more, we're joined by Colorado Public Radio's Binta Berkland. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Binta, you recently spent some time in Berthoud, Colorado, which is just south of Fort Collins, and you talked to voters there. In some ways, the town is representative of other small towns that make up the state. Tell us more about it.
That's right. It has less than 10,000 people, and it's very quaint. It's surrounded by farms and feels rural, yet it's about an hour from Denver, closer to Boulder, and some of these large population centers in the state. And the county it sits in is almost evenly split between registered Democrats and Republicans, and actually the majority of voters are unaffiliated. But in 2016, President Donald Trump won Berthoud by a comfortable margin, even though he lost in Colorado.
When you talked with Republican voters there in Berthoud, what were some of the issues motivating their continued support of President Trump?
Still this idea that he's not a typical politician. One person did tell me that he's the lesser of two evils. And others, like Vance Bunker, really like some of Trump's policies. One of Bunker's top issues is gun rights. He's 53 years old, and he's a home builder.
I'm probably going to be voting for President Trump. He's not your normal politician. I like his foreign policy. I think the rest of the world is half scared of what he's going to do, and I like that idea. I'm glad that he's bringing troops home, and we need to get out of there.
Has President Trump's illness with COVID-19 impacted at all folks like this gentleman that you spoke with and their support of him?
Not that I've heard. I've reached back out to some of those Trump supporters, and they say they all wish him well. They hope he and his family recover, but it doesn't change anything for them. One person said of the president getting coronavirus that it was probably bound to happen.
Throughout the campaign, President Trump has evoked the need to protect the suburban way of life. Is that a message resonating with voters? Is there any sense that cities are driving the state's progressive shift?
Yes, I think to some degree that's exactly right. It's also for some people about preserving what they see as the American way of life. And they feel that some people are trying to change the fabric and some of the freedoms this country's founded on. And Jackie Nelson, who's Vance's wife, you know, she's originally from Montana, and she sees it almost as this larger rural-urban divide. And she doesn't think the country right now is set up for people to have productive discussions on really contentious issues facing the country.
You know, something else this year has been defined by the pandemic, but also the country's division around issues of racial justice and policing. And we tend to focus on places like Kenosha and Portland, but Berthoud has not escaped those divisions. What do you find?
Yeah, it hasn't, even though it's more homogenous racially than some larger urban areas. But the town has had some Black Lives Matter protests, and then it had a Back the Blue rally to support law enforcement. And the protests were contentious, and the city is looking into how law enforcement handled everything. A recent Black Lives Matter protest was canceled after counter-protesters said they would show up in force. And the organizers were worried after the last presidential debate, after President Trump told the Proud Boys to stand by.
Hmm. How else does this play out among residents there? How are they thinking about the election?
People are very divided. I talked to Mike Solter, and the issue of racial justice is top of mind for him. He's 38 years old. He grew up in the area, not in Berthoud, but not far away. And then he lived in Alaska for a decade and recently moved back. He's one of the few Black residents in this mostly white town.
It feels like we're going back to the times when open racism is okay, when it's okay to just declare that something is fake and people will believe you. And that genuinely concerns me.
And what's interesting is, you know, he's supporting Biden, and his neighbors on either side had Trump signs in their front yards. And he introduced me to one of his next door neighbors. Her name is Stacy Ligner. He was dropping off a watermelon for her from his garden. And she's white. She's in her 50s. She has a very different take on the country's divisions.
I personally don't think that there is a racial thing. That's my belief. Everybody is the same. Whether you are black or white, you're still the same. And I'm tired of people saying, well, I'm black, so this is why I'm getting treated that way. Quit your whining.
That's really an interesting situation there, where you have two neighbors who regularly talk to each other and are giving each other gifts, but they believe very different things about this particular issue.
And what's interesting is Solter's daughter, who's a ninth grader, was the person who organized the Black Lives Matter protests. And she told me she's heard some racist comments at school. And for her, you know, it's her lived experience. And she said she feels like a lot of people don't understand that or don't even believe that.
That's Binta Berklin from Colorado Public Radio with a glimpse of a divided town in Colorado ahead of the election. Thank you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.